So this evening, I'd like to offer some reflections drawing on the theme of this retreat in this fathom-long body and using the context from which that was shared by the Buddha as a platform to look a bit more deeply at this way of talking about experience as something we build. So looking a bit more in depth at how we build our experience and what that means for us. So the Buddha was posed a question by a man called Rohitasa. And the question was, "Sir, is it possible to know or see or reach the end of the world by travelling to a place where there's no being born, growing old, dying, passing away, or being reborn?" And the Buddha's final response was this: "Friend, I say it's not possible to know or see or reach the end of the world by travelling to a place where there's no being born, growing old, dying, passing away, or being reborn. But I also say there's no making an end of a suffering without reaching the end of the world. For it is in this fathom-long body, with its perception and mind, that I declare the world, its origin, its cessation, and the path of practice that leads to its cessation." So let's try to unpack that a little in a way that's helpful. So coming to the end of the world where there's no being born, growing old, dying, passing away, or being reborn is basically dukkha. It's Rohitasa's version of what dukkha is. This, as I talked about before, this sense of our journey through life being uncomfortable because somehow it doesn't fit with how we would like things to be. And the Buddha says that actually the only way we can come to an end of dukkha is by coming to the end of the world. So what does the Buddha mean by world in this context? I think it's important here to not see this literally. For the Buddha, he was taking what in modern psychology we might call a phenomenological approach. He was talking about the world of experience, how each of us experiences the world. And you may have noticed how actually we tend to experience the world very differently, each of us. It's almost like each of us has our own personal world of experience. I don't know, you might have noticed when you have an argument or a disagreement with a close friend or a partner, a member of the family, you've both in effect gone through the same experience. Maybe something was said, but your experience of what was said can be very, very different. So in a sense, the same experience has gone on, or the same stimulus has arisen between you, but the experience of it, the perception of it, can be very, very different. And often this is brought home to me when I go for a walk with my partner. We often go for a walk along the Cornish coast. And she's an artist. And when we're out walking along the coast, she points out and talks about the colours, the subtlety of colours she sees on the horizon, in the sea, in the setting sun in the sky. And for me, it's not the same. I don't see it in quite the same way. And often, actually, what I'm experiencing, although we're looking at the same thing, is actually something slightly different. Actually, sometimes it's more the sounds of the sea and the birds that's actually stimulating me in terms of my world of experience at that moment. Yet we're both in the same place, viewing the same countryside, the same seascape, and actually open to and hearing the same sounds. But our world is actually subtly different. So what the Buddha's starting to point to is actually what we need to bring to an end is actually our belief that our world is the real world, is how things actually are. And there's another place where the Buddha talks about how one of the troubles we have is our tendency to go to a binary polarity, that things either are or are not, they exist or they don't exist, that they're real or they're unreal. And the Buddha's wary of this. He talks about actually, he teaches a middle way between these polarities, that actually things are arising dependent on conditions. When the conditions are there, it comes into being. When the conditions cease, they cease to be. So we can't say anything is actually fully existent or also fully non-existent. When it is there, we experience it. It is our world of experience in that moment. And when the conditions change, the experience is no longer there. It is no longer our world of experience. So the Buddha talks about it's in this fathom-long body with its perception and its mind. So although we emphasize a lot the body, actually how we perceive and what's going on in the mind is also part of this path to freedom. And he finishes with this, how he teaches the world, its origin, its cessation, and the path leading to cessation, which is an echo of what are commonly known as the Four Ennobling Truths, what I approached as the four tasks last night. So here again, he's echoing this idea that there's actually freedom is something that involves us doing something. It involves a set of tasks of coming to know our world of experience and how dukkha is interwoven into that, but also can arise out of our world of experience and how it creates conflict. What arises or what is arisen from that dukkha is our reactivity, our push-pull, our craving, and that task of letting go of that. And in the letting go of that, knowing the cessation of the craving, knowing that creative space from which we can respond to our situation. And that is bringing into being this path of the Ennobling Eightfold Path. So, to unpack this fathom-long body, perception, mind, and how this creates our world of experience, how it builds a world of experience. Although the Buddha uses the term body at this point, fathom-long body, generally when he talks about our constituents, if you like, of what make us up, He generally refers to form. And form is quite interesting because form is not just the body, it's also the objects of the senses of the body. In other words, the Buddha is pointing to the fact that our experience of the world is intimately embedded within the external world, that we are continuously impacted by the sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and touches of the world. That actually our experience of the world, our experience of ourselves, can't be separated from that. We're embedded within the world. So our experience is always an arising of external conditions and internal conditions, and how they meet and build an experience in that moment. So we have this form, this physical aspect of our experience, and then we have the mental aspect. So we have perception, and we have what he terms mind. And perception generally is part of mind, but he's actually pulled it out here because actually it's quite an important part of this puzzle. Perception is actually our sense making of our sensory input. So if we take you right now listening to my voice, it's sound waves coming out of my larynx and formation of my mouth, which are then traveling down through technology and wires. And they come out as sound waves from your speaker. And those sound waves are received by the ear and through various mechanisms transformed to our brain, our mind. And suddenly, miraculously, they become words that make sense to you. And they make sense to you both in terms of actually they're words that you understand. Now, if I suddenly started speaking Irish Gaelic, because I'm Irish, although I don't actually speak much of the language, the possibility is none of you would understand anything I said, but I'm still making sound waves and words that actually mean something. So there's a certain way in which you have been conditioned to understand language in a particular way that makes sense. But also, you interpret the words through your own experience. So, although I may say something and that has a particular meaning for you, or for me, sorry, when you hear those words and they are interpreted within your being, they may actually have a slightly different meaning, a slightly different set of understandings for you, depending on your experience, depending on your conditioning, depending on the meaning you give to certain words. So our perception has both that sense of making sense of the sensory input, but it also comes along with our own personal meanings we give to it, our own associations that come from our own particular conditioning and our own past experiences. And we all have what we might call habits of perception, ways that we tend to see things from certain perspectives. They might be influenced by the beliefs we have, the views we have. They might be influenced by particular experiences we had in the past. They might be influenced by actually conditioning that comes down through generations. So, an example for this for me would be something like, how would I explain this? So, sometimes when I am watching a documentary that involves Ireland, so just to put it in context, I was born in England to Irish parents. I moved back when I was a child to Ireland. Lived in Ireland till I was about 25, and then have since lived here for over 35 years. So, in one sense, I've lived more time in England. But my perception is of myself as Irish. That's the identity I have, because that's the conditioning I have. And there was an event about maybe 10 years ago now, where for the first time, an English rugby team were going to be playing an Irish rugby team in a place called Croke Park in Dublin. And it was happening in Croke Park in Dublin because the rugby pitch that was generally used by the Irish Rugby Union was being cl had been closed down for repairs. And for the Irish, this had an awful lot of significance because Croke Park was associated with Irish Gaelic football, was associated with the nationalist struggle for independence many, many years ago, but was also associated with an atrocity by British rulers at the time against some people who were just playing actually a football match at the time. So when I was watching this and actually listening to the perspective on it, I could feel the meaning for it within my own perception of actually this being quite momentous, because it carried a whole lot of meaning that had come down through generations of struggle for independence, of oppression, but also of actually change, of something moving. That actually we didn't have to be held under the sway of that. And all that meaning was held in what was nothing other than, for many people who would be independent observers, the fact that a rugby match was taking place between two teams. So we bring a lot of past associations, a lot of conditioning to our perception. And this can actually ultimately be quite a cause of strife in the world and in our lives. So you might have had this experience yourself. A dispute arises, as I mentioned earlier, between yourself and a friend or a family member. And you perceive it in a particular way, and they perceive it in a different way. So they have a different experience, a different interpretation of what went on, and you have another one. And our tendency with our perception is to take it as being real, the truth. This is actually how it really is. So if that's how it actually is, if my version and my perception is the reality, then I must be right and you must be wrong. So if I'm right and you're wrong, then I need to defend my position. And I need to make you know that you're wrong. And you can see within that dynamic, what we're actually doing is we're actually escalating the conflict, the disagreement. We're actually starting to make it much more personal, because it is no longer that we have a different perception of it. It's actually now that actually I am right. There's this sense of a me coming into being that is right. And at the same time, there is a you that is wrong. And there's that sense of separation that arises between us in that dynamic. And when we actually look much closer at it, we can actually generally start to see that actually the truth of the matter is often somewhere between our perspectives. But also how easy it is for us to actually take the position that being right is more important than harmony, is more important than actually maintaining a sense of goodwill and care and friendliness with another person. And we see this dynamic at play within the world around us, in the polarization in political and religious and economic beliefs, and how that causes so much pain and suffering in the world, to the point that it actually causes violence, harm, and war. So, in any moment of experience, we have perception, this making sense of it. And the Buddha talks about, one of the ways he talks about ignorance is as the distortion of perception. How our perception becomes distorted so that actually we no longer are attuned to what's arising in the moment, but we're actually fixing the moment in relation to our own beliefs, our own ideas, and our own biases and assumptions. But the Buddha also talks about there are other mental qualities that also arise in every moment of conscious experience. And I've mentioned one of them already, Vedana, this feeling tone or this hedonic tone. That arises in every moment of experience. And we also have habits here. And one of the big habits we have in terms of feeling tone is this negativity bias, that our attention tends to be drawn to what's difficult in our experience. It'll tend to be drawn to and highlight what's challenging or uncomfortable in that experience over what is okay, over what is maybe even quite pleasant. And we can see how this can have survival uses in the past, but also it can actually be counterproductive. Because what it tends to do is draw our attention, often in ways that are not very helpful. So again, we might have, if I come back to myself, I might have given a talk and actually talk lasted half an hour. It went quite well, but there was one point where I got a bit lost and wasn't quite sure what I was saying. And then at the end of the talk, when I kind of reflect back, the bit that stands out is that 2 minutes of actually getting lost and being a bit of unsure maybe about what I was saying. And the other 28 minutes that felt quite okay and seemed to flow get lost. That my attention has gotten drawn to that negative aspect of my experience. And this tendency of the mind to move to the negative and highlight that in our experience actually causes us a lot of distress and discomfort. And it feeds into that tendency many of us have to actually be self-critical, to have what's often referred to as the inner critic. That sense of self-judgment, So one of the things that can be quite useful, and what we do a lot in meditation, is learn to actually place the attention where it's more helpful. When we rest the attention on the body, the breath, on sounds, what we're learning, part of what we're learning to do, is actually anchor the attention in a way that it's not automatically drawn away to what is potentially difficult in our experience, but also that it doesn't start to proliferate that aspect of our experience. So I also reference there attention, and attention is also another part of our mental faculty that's always there, present in any moment of conscious experience. And attention also has these habits, these movements. For most of us, sight tends to be our predominant sense door. We navigate the world much more through sight than we do through the other faculties. So we experience the world in a particular way through sight, and we experience that world very differently to somebody who's visually impaired, where sight wouldn't be their primary way of experiencing the world. It may be more through touch and through sound, and they'll have a very different sensory experience of the world. But also within that, we will tend to pick out different aspects of the visual field. So I remember going for a walk some years ago when I was a coordinator at Gaia House, one of the volunteer living staff. And I went for a walk with this friend along the coastline quite nearby in Devon. And it was quite interesting. On one side, there is the railway line that goes along the coast to Newton Abbot, the nearest station. And on the other side of the pathway we were on was the beach and the sea and the horizon. And as we were walking down that pathway, what I was noticing and where my attention was drawn was to the seascape, to the beach, the sea, the sound of the waves. And I was really enjoying walking along this pathway with my friend. And I noticed that my friend was a bit agitated. And when I actually talked to her, she was actually noticing, and where her attention was drawn was to the railway line and to the other side, where the embankment, where there was this netting to kind of hold the rock face in place. And she had this sense of the ugliness of it. Her attention was being drawn to what was actually, for her, quite unpleasant within what was available for us to pay attention to. So her attention was being drawn in that particular way to what she felt was quite threatening, rather than to what was quite nourishing and enlivening on the other side of the path. So we have these particular habits of how we direct our attention, the way our attention is drawn in terms of the feeling tone, but also these associations and these biases that we bring to our perception. And alongside with that, we have all the other things that can arise in the mind, the thoughts that arise, the qualities of the heart that may arise, and that. And what these start to do is they start to build our experience. So The general way we build our experience is very habitually. It's driven by these habits of attention, these habits of perception, and this habit of reactivity to feeling tone. And what we find is we find that this creates this push-pull with our experience that I've been talking about over the weekend. This beginning of this slight, so at this point, initially, it's just a slight push-pull. It's that initial kind of thing of there's something here that I'm starting to actually move against. I'm actually reaching to start to hold on to it, or I'm reaching to start to actually push it away, or actually it's not of much interest to me, so I'm starting to look for something that's more stimulating, more interesting. And this starts to build this movement of craving, this movement of actually, if we don't notice it, of actually starting to become more entangled in the experience. So as we start to become more entangled, the perception starts to arise that I like this, I don't like this, or I'm not interested in this. And this initial reactivity or craving starts to become what the Buddha terms clinging. We start to actually become more entangled in the experience. But what's also happening is we're starting to become more abstracted from the experience. So that we're no longer actually there with the felt experience, with the pleasantness or unpleasantness, but we're actually starting to move into strategies of how do I hold on to this? How do I get rid of this? What can I do to stimulate myself? What's more interesting in my environment in the moment? What can I think about that will distract me? And what also starts to come in here as well is time. So when we're with the immediacy of our bodily felt experience, our sensory experience in the moment, it's only ever in the present moment. We can only feel what's actually arising in our senses and in our body in the moment. But our mind has the capability to time travel. We can move back to the past, comparison with a different time. So that sense of actually, it was better back then. That sense of maybe loss, that sense of comparison, or that association we have from the past comes more into play. So, this is what it was like before, so this is what it's going to be like now. Or our mind can move into the future. So that sense of actually, it's always going to be like this. It's never going to change, that fixing of it. Or that sense of spiraling into some fantasy of how it may be or how it could be or how we can escape. Or that fantasy that just distracts us from the fact that actually this moment isn't enough for us. Nothing much is happening. So we stimulate a sense of fantasy, of daydreaming about something more interesting. So there's this abstraction, this movement away into thought and a movement away from the direct experience of it. So as this clinging becomes tighter, what it tends to do, it tends to actually increase the feeling tone. You might notice this, that actually our experience becomes more unpleasant when we really become entangled in an experience because we're actually building the experience. or our attention, our perception become more locked into it so that other aspects of our experience aren't available to us. And as this proliferates, as we think about it more, as we agitate about it more, as we become more abstracted, what starts to come into being is a me that's actually revolving around it. A fixed sense of me, that of I am right, I am angry, you are wrong. So when the sense of me comes into place, also the sense of you comes into place. And that sense of separation, that sense of distance comes into place with another person. And then, of course, then this can really spiral to the point of overwhelm and actually harm. If we really pursue this movement to its ultimate end, where it often leads to is harm, either harm to ourselves or harm to another. And we see this again and again in the world, that as we build this contraction around some aspect of our experience, some belief, some way of perceiving the world, that actually we create that sense of me and other, that sense of separation, and the possibility of actually causing harm. This building of experience in this way isn't a given. It's actually just an habitual way of moving from this push-pull with experience, these habitual ways of seeing the world and framing and perceiving the world, that so quickly moves into this habit of push-pull, perception of liking, disliking, starting to cling more tightly to the experience, and then starting to abstract more into thought and into distance from the experience. And from that distance from the experience, the birthing of a sense of a me that is actually fixated around that experience, that solidifies around that experience. And we know that experience for ourselves. You know, if we can remember back to times when actually it was almost like this two-year-old having an internal tantrum in our heads when life isn't quite going the way we want, where it's like that sense of me and this is what I want and it's not like this. And it can really feel like this solid, concrete sense of self that's so fixed and impermeable and, in a sense, rages against the world in its extreme. But as I said, this isn't a given. Christina Feldman has a lovely way of talking about this. How we're always practicing something. We're always bringing something into being. So every time we practice or we cultivate, even though it's an unconscious, we wouldn't think of it as practicing as in a conscious way that we usually associate with practice. We are still, in a sense, practicing habit patterns. So every time we follow that movement of push-pull, clinging, that abstraction into thought, into distancing, and the birthing of a me in that moment, we're reinforcing that habit pattern. But we don't change the habit pattern by actively trying to change the habit pattern. How we change these habit patterns is by cultivating a different way of being, by cultivating such qualities that we've been looking at over this weekend, such as loving kindness, joy, compassion, equanimity, patience, generosity, mindfulness. All these qualities, such as wise effort and wise view. It's through these that what we actually start to do over time is displace the unhelpful habit patterns with more helpful habit patterns, more helpful ways of responding. So that actually, when that push-pull starts to arise, rather than actually moving into like and dislike, we could actually bring kindness to it. And in that kindness, creating that space whereby actually, rather than reacting and building the experience, there's a possibility of finding some way of responding that actually meets what's arising in the moment more helpfully. So, what practice is calling us to do is twofold. One is to cultivate these more wholesome ways of being in the world so that they gradually displace these more unwholesome habit patterns we have. But the second thing we're also being called to do is actually notice what are the habitual ways we react, what are the habitual ways we perceive the world, what are the lenses through which we view the world, what are the ways that our attention habitually gets drawn. Not to make things right or wrong, but just to actually, in that understanding, there's the possibility, in alignment with actually bringing other qualities into being, that actually mean we can build a different experience. Because it's not a case that we stop building experience. We are still always going to be, as long as we're alive, perceiving the world. The world is going to have a certain meaning for us. But if the meaning is driven by such things as actually non-harming, kindness, of wishing to promote harmony and a sense of connection rather than separation, then there's the possibility that actually our life over time starts to change. Not because we're actively trying to change our lives, but just because actually in bringing into being these qualities that we value, change just naturally starts to happen. So we're not changing ourselves because there's anything wrong with ourselves. We're just actually cultivating ways of being that we value. And these ways of being then in themselves bring about change. So the Buddha made this quite famous comment about this process, in a sense. He says, "O house builder, you have been seen. You shall not build the house again. Your rafters have been broken up. Your ridge pole is demolished too. My mind has now attained the unformed nibbana and reached the end of craving." So what he's alluding to here is that part of his awakening is this seeing clearly and this understanding of how we build this house of experience or this world of experience. And as we start to actually see that process, as we become more familiar with it, as we start to see how it actually limits us and actually is that process of adding the second arrow and the third arrow and the fourth arrow, the more we build it, the more actual distress and discomfort and pain and suffering we're causing ourselves. The more we see that, and at the same time start to cultivate different ways of actually responding to our experience, these qualities that we've been emphasizing over the weekend, then the possibility comes that rather than actually reacting and going through this movement of craving and building the experience, that there's actually the possibility of response without the craving. And it's not that this is necessarily something that happens and that's it for good. But in any moment, that possibility is there for us. When we spot that this is, we're starting to build that process, and we just pause. And in that moment of pause, bring another quality that actually creates some spaciousness, that supports a releasing and a softening of that craving. Then there's the possibility in that moment of actually responding in a different way, a way that isn't habitual, a way that actually comes from a deeper wisdom and intuition about how we can meet this moment in a way that actually takes care of it.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.